Now, part of the factory made alloys that could not be manufactured on Earth, alloys that were stronger yet lighter than any earthly metals could be because they had been made in zero gravity, where the molten elements could mix perfectly. Other sections of the factory manufactured special plastics, crystals for electronic equipment, pharmaceutical products that cured diabetes and other hormonal diseases. But none of that interested Dan at the moment. Working the control studs on the arms of his jetpack, he made his way from the slowly rotating wheels of the space station toward the graceless utilitarian clutter of the factory. As he approached it, Dan could see several shuttles hovering at the factory's loading docks, taking on cargo for return to Earth. Space-suited astronauts scurried back and forth around the shuttles like silvery ants busily working at their tasks. Dan identified himself to the traffic controller at the factory's monitoring center and heard her calm, sure voice in his helmet earphones acknowledging his call and giving him clearance to approach. He jetted past the loading docks, through the maze of interconnected struts and beams that linked the factory's various components together, and headed straight toward the odd collection of shapes that floated a few hundred meters beyond the factory's outstretched solar panels. The asteroid ship was taking shape out there. It was a weird-looking assemblage of parts, a bulbous metal egg that housed the crew's living quarters, a collection of propellant tanks that would be filled with nothing more than water, plastic pods for holding tools and equipment, and a small oblong metal box about the size and shape of an oversized coffin, which contained the nuclear power plant that delivered the electricity for the spacecraft and its propulsion thrusters. The various modules of the craft were painted gleaming white except for the lead-shielded nuclear power plant, which had been daubed blood red. "Dolphin One," Dan called into his helmet microphone. "Dan Randolph coming aboard." "Welcome aboard, Mr. Randolph." He heard the voice of Nobuhiko Yamagata, clear and strong, in his earphones. The spacecraft looked anything but like a sleek dolphin. Its name came from the fact that the dolphin was one of the disguises of the Greek god Apollo, and the mission of this ship was to intercept one of the small asteroids that passed relatively near Earth in its orbit. The astronomers called such pieces of rock the Apollo class of asteroids. Dan expertly throttled his braking thrusters to kill his forward velocity. He reached the crew pod's curving hull with a feather-light touch, worked the push-button controls to open the hatch, and pulled himself inside. Once he had cycled through the airlock and stepped through the inner hatch, there was a technician waiting to help him out of the cumbersome spacesuit. Clad in white coveralls that were unmarked except for his last name stenciled over the left breast pocket, Dan made his way through the pod's central corridor in the easy swimming motion of zero gravity. Nobo was sitting in the engineer station, a clipboard thick with papers floating at his left elbow as he checked out the intricate panels of indicator lights and switches. He dipped his head in an informal version of a respectful bow. "It's an honor to have you aboard, sir." Dan automatically nodded back. "How's it going? How's the reactor behaving?" "We haven't run it up to full power yet." "I know, your report last night said there was a glitch with the control system." "Ah, that is why you've come here." "I don't like troubles with something as important as the main power plant, especially a nuke." Nobo smiled. "You Americans have still not overcome your fear of nuclear power, have you?" The smile and the tone of voice appeared overly tolerant, almost condescending. Dan replied, "We're not as fatalistic as you Japanese." "It isn't fatalism. It's a matter of national survival. Hiroshima was a long time ago. We have learned to live with nuclear reactors. We have to, especially since the Russians started marking up the price of oil and natural gas." It was an argument Dan had played out with Saito Yamagata many times over the years. Japan had decided to go heavily into nuclear power rather than buy either Russian oil and natural gas or American coal. Despite the very real fears of accidents and radiation, the Japanese had opted for nuclear and won. Their electrical power systems were the best and safest in the world, and with the extra power they received from their solar power satellites, even their automobiles were electrically powered. The air quality in Tokyo and every other Japanese city was unmarred by the carcinogenic smog that came from burning fossil fuels. "So, what's wrong with the reactor?" Dan asked. Nobuhiko gave him another tolerant smile. "Nothing, really. It's a good piece of Japanese technology. But the control rods were manufactured by a Swiss contractor. They passed inspection in Kyoto, and actually they performed within specified limits in yesterday's test, but barely within the limits. Dan ran a hand across his chin. Nopo had won the assignment to be flight engineer for the asteroid mission. He had worked hard over the past 2 months and shown more intelligence, drive, and dedication than even Dan could have hoped for. The job was his, and the responsibility. But Dan had to give him the power to make and enforce decisions, too. That went with the responsibility. If Nopo said the reactor system was no-go, the mission was postponed, or perhaps canceled altogether. I contacted the manufacturer last night, not from up here. No. Nopo raised a placating hand. I did not compromise our security. I placed a call from Nueva Venezuela to Caracas, which was relayed to Kyoto and from there to Bern. As far as the Swiss know, their control system is being tested on an experimental reactor at the Yamagata Research Institute in the University of Kyoto. Dan let out a long breath. Okay, the Russians are suspicious enough already. Security is important. I understand. Nobo jabbed a stubby finger at a green light glowing steadily in the upper right quadrant of the big monitoring board. The control system is now working within the limits that I have set. The problem was very minor. Just a small adjustment was necessary. Dan gave him a happy grin. In the 8 weeks he had been working for Astro Manufacturing, the young Yamagata had earned himself something of a reputation for insisting on well-nigh perfect performance from every piece of equipment he touched. The technicians joked that there were three sets of specifications for all the equipment delivered for the asteroid mission. The manufacturer's original specs, the natural limits that God set on how well the equipment could work, and the performance that Nobuhiko Yamagata demanded from the equipment. Of the three, Nobo's was the most severe. Yamagata's tougher than God, the technician said. Not all of them were happy about Nobo's lofty standards, but they all respected him for it. Has Dr. Freiberg picked out our destination yet? Nobo asked. The last time I spoke with him, he was undecided among three possible asteroids. Dan said, He's narrowed it down to two, and we'll make the final decision in a day or so. When is the earliest possible time of departure? The nearest window is the end of the month, Dan replied. I don't have the exact time, but it's 10 days from now. Nobo nodded solemnly. We will be fully prepared to go by then. Good. Will Dr. Freiberg accompany us? No. Not that he doesn't want to go, but he stays at Nueva Venezuela during the mission. Security? Damned right. His cover story is that he's setting up an astronomical observatory at the factory. But even if the Russians knew about this mission, what could they do about it? Nobo asked. We have a right to fly out to an asteroid. There is no international law against that. It was Dan's turn to smile tolerantly. Son, you'd be surprised at how fast laws can be written. The Soviets wouldn't hesitate to use force to stop us, and then get a law written afterward. Nobo shrugged his shoulders, but said nothing. The motion lifted him slightly out of his chair. Freiberg stays here, Dan repeated. Hell, if it weren't for the goddamned Russian snoops, I'd go along with you myself. The young Japanese smiled appreciatively. Yes. My father has told me many times of the days when the two of you worked together in space. I thought this mission would be very tempting to you. It is. But it's too important to risk for a personal whim. Dan felt that he was doing the wise thing, the prudent thing, the necessary thing. But a voice in the back of his head asked silently, If you were a couple of years younger, would you still elect to stay behind? He spent most of the day inspecting the spacecraft and saw that Nabu and the rest of the crew would have it ready well before the earliest possible departure date. Carstairs, the rowdy Australian, would captain the mission. And he had picked one of the younger Venezuelan astronauts, Vargas, as his first officer. Dan was satisfied that the ship and its crew were in good shape. But as he jetted back to the space station, he turned his thoughts to other problems. The biggest one was that Jane Scanwell had for 2 solid months refused every attempt he had made to contact her. Dan could understand that the President of the United States would find it politically unpalatable to meet with an American who had renounced his citizenship and run off to another country to set himself up in business there. He could even understand how the widow of his best friend would be furious with him for turning his back on her when she needed